Well, hasn't it been absorbing watching the complicated outflow from the Israeli elections? It could take weeks before the makeup of the new government is finalised. One city that will watch on, though probably wearily, as it's seen so much politics over a couple of millennia, is the subject of our next story, Jerusalem. There's a great line in what I think is the underrated Ridley Scott movie about the Crusades called Kingdom of Heaven, in which the Salahuddin character is asked, what did Jerusalem really mean to him? It's towards the end of the movie, and he says, oh, nothing. And then he follows up quickly with this knowing twinkle in his eye, and everything. It's a great summary, somehow, of the incredibly contradictory responses to this one of the world's great cities, a bustling, dynamic and dirty place, not necessarily imposing. But as our next guest, the classic scholar Simon Goldhill, sees it, Jerusalem can, quotes, fire the imagination like no other place. You might remember I spoke with Simon last year and that he's Professor of Greek Literature and Culture at the University of Cambridge. He's now also the author of Jerusalem, City of Longing. It's a Harvard University publication. Earlier in the week, I welcomed Simon Goldhill back to Saturday Extra.
Good morning. It's very nice to be with you again.
Look, as you say, there's scarcely a beautiful building in Jerusalem to match the grandeurs of Rome or Paris or, say, Florence. So why does it fire your imagination like no other?
It's because it has such a buried life of stories. Every place you stand on the corner of Jerusalem, you think that's just a rock or just a chair or just a doorway. And it turns out to have hundreds of years of people's fantasies built into it. And it produces the most extraordinary effect. Everybody there just walks the streets all the time, looking at these places, looking at where they are, and trying to make sense of themselves through that. It's a very, very moving place, though not an aesthetic dream.
No, in fact, you've got an interesting line in the preface. For every visitor, Jerusalem needs preparation and reflection. It leaves a mark. Before we go into the detail, what mark do you think it did leave on you?
I didn't go to Jerusalem until I was quite old. I put it off like many people. I thought maybe it was dangerous, maybe it would be a strange effect on me. I didn't know what to expect. I turned up there and I found myself getting in touch with all sorts of my own pasts, imagined pasts. They weren't my real past because I had never been there before, and made me feel some way in touch, not just with history, but with my own distorted fantasy of history as well. And that was a very strange and rather disturbing feeling. And I grew to love it. I grew to love the mix of Muslim, Jewish and Christian areas, hanging out with people, talking and listening. And if you can just listen in Jerusalem, you hear so much, so many stories. And they really do help you think about where the world's going.
But did it leave you, because I get a mixed feeling from your book, did it leave you filled with bewilderment and a dismay and dread or not?
No, obviously there are a lot of people in Jerusalem who are frankly a bit loopy. You know, that's where people go if they think they're Jesus. It's where people go if they think the end of the world is coming. And so there are a lot of people on the street who would make you feel a bit strange. There are a lot of very committed people. A lot of the people in Jerusalem shout at each other all the time. And if you don't like that, it's very disturbing. But I think it's impossible to have anything other but extreme emotions. So, yeah, there are bits of Jerusalem I absolutely loathe. I can't bear what people have done to the city in all sorts of ways, the planning laws, the way people misbehave. But there are moments you just turn that corner and suddenly a vista opens up in front of you and you're lost in love all over again. It's really like a very, very powerful person. Mm. You both love and you can't live with them, you can't live without them. You know, it's a very, very strange city.
Some of the critics have said, praising your book, say Simon Goldhill looks at the heavenly and the earthly aspects of Jerusalem.
Well, I think that's true. There are some heavenly moments, but they're very much grounded in the here and now. You can go to somewhere like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where Jesus is said to be to have been put in a tomb and have risen, and where Golgotha is, the site of the crucifixion. And if you went there last Easter, you would have had a foul smell in the church because the toilets were blocked. And the Greeks, the Armenians, and the Roman Catholics all have to agree before any work can be done on the church. And they were having a disagreement. So the Armenians, I think it was, wouldn't let the Greeks mend the toilet. And so we went through Easter with this foul smell and sewage coming out because they were arguing about something. Now, that's about as earthly as it gets. And there it is, you know, in the most holy place of Christianity. That earthliness, it's very difficult to deal with sometimes.
Well, and indeed, you do talk about the Dome of the Rock, clearly. I mean, there's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, there's the Al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rock, at once, you say, the most beautiful building in Jerusalem, which, of course, is a Muslim shrine. And then there's the all the various Temple Mount is actually the Jewish.
This is typical of the problem of Jerusalem. The Temple Mount is the site of the Jewish temple that Herod built that was destroyed by the Romans back in 70. Now, on top of the Temple Mount now is the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, which are two of the most holy sites of Islam. And so this is a site that has this deep Jewish history and this present Muslim religiosity. And so that's, you know, one of the greatest sources of argument between various people, because it has this visible history. You can see the stones of Herod from the year, you know, the year 1. And above these stones, on the stones, are built this beautiful, beautiful Dome of the Rock. And you can't separate them. They're absolutely intertwined.
So why, tell me about the Dome of the Rock. Why, what is it that is so beautiful?
It has a shape like none other. It has this absolutely extraordinary, elegant dome and beautiful surround with the pillars. But what makes it so special for me isn't just that shape. It's the incredible tiles that are all over it. Bright blue, gold, red, yellow, these incredible colors. And against the blue of the sky, against the white of the marble of the Temple Mount, it just stands out in the most extraordinary way, overlooking the whole city. You can see it from so many places. And it's one of those images that is just iconic of the city.
And it was designed to be just that, wasn't it?
It's not a mosque, although people often call it a mosque. It's not a mosque. It's a site of pilgrimage. And it was designed to say, we're here now, and we are taller and bigger than the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Mm. That's exactly its point. The competitive architecture has been part of Jerusalem since the beginning.
So at the beginning of your book, just by complete contrast, though, you discuss the El Alami House, I think it's pronounced, which, as you say, epitomises all the surprise, wonder and problems of multidimensional ownership in Jerusalem. Tell us about this house, please.
Well, this was an extraordinary experience for me. By as usual way, I met a friend of a friend of a friend who introduced me to this woman called Saida El Alami. I went up to her house. And if location, location, location is everything in real estate, this is the most extraordinary piece of real estate in the world, because it is a small, crusader-built, white brick house between the two domes of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So it's like having a house, you know, on the top of Westminster Abbey or St. Paul's or wherever, or on the, you know, I don't know, above the top of the roof of the Sydney Harbour, you know, the Opera House. You know, it's the most extraordinary sight. It's been there forever. She lives there. She has her own little entrance. She has to climb up. And first of all, it's very beautiful. She has the most great views, as you can imagine, with these domes surrounding her little terrace garden. But what's so funny about it is that the roof is owned by Arab. It's Arab Waqf property. That's religious-owned property. Down below the roof is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is Christian-owned property. And, you know, above, I guess, is God's, you know, it's the sky. But you have this extraordinary, how deep does the roof go then? We can't answer that question. But it's this extraordinary, these buildings layered on top of it, with, you know, the Muslim living in a crusader house on top of the church.
A house where Saladin stayed, according to history.
So we're told. You know, you can believe that if you like. Jerusalem.
Well, in fact, you do say that leads me rather nicely to your next claim, that in fact, for a city that can be so life-changing and so remarkable as you're suggesting, it's also full of the inauthentic.
It's extraordinary that I suppose I do call it the inauthentic, because people put so much emphasis on the authenticity of experience there. But most of the things you see have been built and rebuilt. That's just the buildings. And so many holy objects are patently not real, authentic. I don't want to get too controversial, of course. But take, for example, if you go into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you can now go and see, as one of the relics from the medieval age, it's very carefully preserved, although they don't show it to many people, they have the skull of the Good Samaritan. Now, the Good Samaritan is a character in a story. He kind of had a skull, but there it is. That's a sort of very strange version of authenticity. And for many medieval pilgrims going, that was a big moment to see the skull of the guy they read about in the story.
Yes.
And I find that fascinating, to see those sorts of inventions but then take on a life of their own.
Are you unable to escape the past there? I remember once speaking to a man in Florence years ago, and he said, you know, I said, it's a beautiful city. He said, yes, but of course we can't build anything new. And I'd never thought of that, really. Does it sort of stamp on anybody trying to refresh the place?
Far from it. Because of the nature of war in the area, the so-called old city, which is where many people go, is one of the newest parts of the city. It's right around the center, around in Jerusalem, in the walled city. Huge amounts were destroyed in the 1948 war and the 1967 war as well, with the result that a lot of the time they've reconstructed the buildings to make a sort of museum of its own past. There's also some very beautiful new buildings, one or two, and some very ugly ones.
And what are they like, these new buildings? Do they nod to the history, or do they strike out completely anew? And I wonder what that striking out is.
Well, there's sort of three sorts. At the lowest level, there's bombastic, oppressive, military-style architecture built by all sorts of people, which just wants to say, we're here, we own this, we're big and proud, and I hate that sort of architecture. Then you get reconstruction, where people say, I want to rebuild it just as it was. Now, of course, you can never quite rebuild things just as they were. And so you have this sort of fantasy of a medieval city being rebuilt in modern techniques and modern material. And so that's a sort of fantasy world. That's sort of a Disney World version of old times. And then you have some really stunning modern architecture. The Supreme Court is one of the more beautiful buildings in Europe, I think, and that's completely modernist and very exciting. And at one level you do get, at least you have had, some lovely combination buildings. So the British Government House, which is now the UN building, was built with Arabic style but with modern architecture. It has an absolutely beautiful interior and a very, very impressive exterior too. So there's a whole host of things. It's a terrible jumble.
Did the British leave much behind, by the way, that you can recognise as British?
Yeah, not only buildings, but they completely redesigned the city in ways that people forget. So one of my particular heroes was a chap called Charlie Ashby, who was the first civic advisor, the first town planner of Jerusalem under the British Mandate in the first decades of the 20th century. And he was an old-style Pre-Raphaelite, arts and crafts, garden city movement guy. And he it was that cleared the buildings around the walls, rebuilt the walls, passed the law that you can only build in Jerusalem stone, which is still in place, cleared like a garden city. He made open space around so you could see the walls of Jerusalem. And so by their planning, they really created what has become the iconic image of Jerusalem in everybody's imagination. I mean, people think this went back a very, very long way, this image that we have of Jerusalem. It's actually a 1920s construction. Mm.
And just before I let you go, the gardens that you mentioned too, the spacious and beautiful gardens on the Temple Mount, where Haram al-Sharif, where Al-Aqsa and the Dome stand and the Temple stood, does everyone prize those, or is it just a particular group of Jerusalem that prizes those?
Well, I think everybody who has any sense would regard the Temple Mount up there as one of the most beautiful and calm and spiritual places in the world. It has an extraordinary vista. You can see across to the Mount of Olives, those associations. You have fantastically beautiful Islamic architecture all around you. And you have these beautiful old olive trees and other plants growing. And it's an absolutely wonderful place. As one of my Arab sources says from the 15th century, he says, heaven is sitting in the shade of the Dome of the Rock eating a banana. there's a lot to be said for that.
Wonderful. Simon Goldhill, I'm deeply envious. You've piqued my interest even more. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Absolute pleasure. Bye-bye.
Simon Goldhill, whose book is called Jerusalem, City of Longing. It's a Harvard University publication. I must just mention before we go that By Design, which follows us, will this morning look at designs for fireproofing houses. So it's very timely. What are the safest thoughts these days and why? And a very quick mention. Well, I've had some listeners asking, where's the Saturday Extra film review? Well, the answer is that because of Radio National schedule changes, we've got movie time now on Friday morning, and we felt that we might, in fact, bring a sports cameo to you that we're working on for sort of sports lovers and non-sports lovers alike. So that'll be with you very shortly, possibly even next week. So do tune into Julie Rigg on Friday morning at 8:30. Thank you very much for your time. Have a wonderful weekend. It's 9 o'clock.